This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Mark Fisher is with the Washington Post. His new book is Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Mark joins us on the long line from his office in D.C. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Great, Coy. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I just appreciate you making some time for us. I also want to let folks know that you write Raw Fisher, one of the very popular blogs at blog.washingtonpost.com, The Cold Splash of Reality with a Side of Sizzle. How long have you been doing that blog?
Oh, the blog's been up for about a year and a half now. It kind of is an outgrowth of the column that I write 3 days a week in The Washington Post, and it's been a lot of fun jumping in there and joining all the other bloggers around the state.
I want to tell you, I was just telling folks that in the last hour, I finished the book last night. I have had so much fun reading this book. I really tell you, and I will say I interview a lot of authors on this program, and some of the books I sort of read and I think, yeah, this is okay, but I really enjoyed reading this. Thank you, number one, for writing this book. It is a terrifically fun book about the history of radio in America, and for anyone who has any interest in radio, I'd recommend that they pick it up. What prompted this? Are you just a radio fan from way back?
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, yes, I've loved radio pretty much all my life. I was one of those kids who went to sleep with the transistor radio under the pillow, trying to extend the day without my parents knowing about it. And as I go around talking about the book, it turns out that was a very common way of staying up later for folks growing up in the, well, the 50s, 60s, 70s, into the early 80s. And it's really that period that I'm writing about. It, you know, what got me very curious about that time was what we're going through right now in this country, where we're all swimming in a sea of information. We've got so many choices when it comes to media. And what I keep hearing from people is, what do you do to fight a path through that sea of information? And it reminded me of what I'd been reading about what happened when TV came along. And radio was the one big mass medium in the country, and everyone gave radio up for dead. Just like people talk about print and books and radio and television right now, losing audience to the internet. Well, I wanted to go back to that time and study it and understand what happens to old media when new technologies come along. And I was able to find some parallels and draw some lessons from that.
And some of those lessons are?
Well, first of all, old media really tend not to die. They change the kind of audience that they're shooting for, and they change the kind of creative material that they're presenting. And that's what radio did at the moment when everyone thought it was really going down the tubes. And the innovation tends to come not from the big corporations, not from the big networks. The radio networks in New York after TV came along almost didn't pay any further attention to radio. The innovation came from small places, from individual station owners in the least expected places. A lot of them were in the Midwest. And these were guys who were desperate for programming. And so they were ready and willing to break some taboos, taboos such as the one that said that you couldn't play records on the radio, or the one that said you couldn't play the same song on the radio within 1 month of the last time it had been played.
Well, we want to talk about one of those guys in just a minute. Of course, Todd Storrs, who got it all started. But before we do, I found that fascinating in the book that there was a time in radio when you legally weren't allowed to play records, and that radio was all about live performances, and then TV came along and that changed.
It really did. You know, this was really a result of the musicians' union trying to protect jobs for their members, and so they had this theory that you shouldn't play records on the radio because then no one would buy records. And so they insisted that networks and local stations have their own bands, their own orchestras, and so it was a great boon for employment of musicians. But when this taboo was broken, of course, we learned that exactly the opposite was true, that the more you played the records on the radio, the more people would go out and buy them because they became familiar favorites. That seems absolutely obvious to us now, but it was really counterintuitive back in the 1940s.
And, of course, a parallel today is folks are saying, well, you can't put the Daily Show clips on YouTube because then folks won't watch the Daily Show, when, in fact, studies show it's just the opposite.
Exactly right. And now we have the spectacle of the the recording industry and the movie industry going out and suing college students because they're sharing materials or they're downloading or they're watching stuff on YouTube. And obviously they haven't learned from history, because history teaches us that if you give people access to this kind of material, it only whets their appetite for more, and most people are going to do the right thing and pay for the artistic work somewhere along the chain.
My guest is Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. His new book is Something in the Air, Radio Rock and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Mark, tell us about Todd Storrs and the birth of Top 40 Radio.
You know, we think of Top 40 radio nowadays, and it sounds like, oh, that was that bubblegum stuff, and it really was banal, and no one ever took it seriously. But Top 40 radio was really a revolution in media, because it was the first time that radio, that any mass medium, aimed its programming at one particular group of Americans, in this case, young people. Before that, back in the so-called golden age of radio, 1930s and 40s, all the programming was aimed at everybody. The family would gather around those wooden cathedral radios in the living room. Well, when TV came along, the programming was gone. And a station owner such as this guy, Todd Storrs, out in Omaha, Nebraska, he was a rich kid, the son of the local brewer, and his father bought him a radio station more or less as a plaything. I know sort of thing happens to all of us, I'm sure. But he woke up one day, and all of the big shows on his radio station had moved off of radio and moved over to TV. And he was left trying to figure out what to put on. Well, he would spend his evenings in a diner where he had a particular waitress who he had his eye on. He would tend to stick around while the waitresses were cleaning up, and he noticed that they were all plunking their nickels into the jukebox to hear the same songs over and over again. And this flew in the face of the common wisdom in the radio industry back then. And so he decided that not only was he going to play records on the radio, but he was going to play the same ones, the favorites, over and over again. And that was a total taboo, but he broke it, and obviously it became the absolute rule for how radio would operate for years to come.
Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, his new book is Something in the Air. We're going to take a very quick break, and on our way out, let's hear a little bit of Todd Storrs back at WHB in Kansas City.
The WHB electronic time tone is accurate to within 1/20,000th of a second. At the tone, exactly 7 o'clock. More music, more often, on WHB.
That gets the second hour of the musical clock underway. White Silver Sands by Bill Black's Combo. 2 minutes past seven. WHB Happy Time. 56 degrees here in Kansas City. Right now it is 57. It's up a degree. 57 degrees in our town.
Smoke pell-mell. Never too strong, never too weak. Buy pell-mell famous cigarettes. Outstanding. And they are mild.
Indeed, they are mild. 3 minutes past seven. WHB Happy Time.
My money.
Todd Storrs at WHB in Kansas City. You're listening to News Radio 1070. We're talking with Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. His new book, terrific book, is Something in the Air, Radio Rock and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Mark, we were listening to Todd Storrs there. He really changed everything.
He really did. He created the whole notion that a radio station was a place that you turned to for one format, where you could expect the same kind of programming all day long, as opposed to more of the TV model, where there'd be a different type of program every hour. And he also created this idea that you could aim your programming at a particular segment of the audience, in this case, young people. He tapped into the beginning of the baby boom and to the beginnings of both rock and roll and the early R&B sounds, and the result was a revolution in what radio meant, how people used radio. And that change in the popular culture, I think, had an important role in changing the whole social and political fabric of the country in the following 10, 20 years through the 50s and 60s.
And that process, beginning in the 40s with Todd Storrs and then into the 50s with Gordon McLendon and the 60s, where we see the continued demographic breakdown as radio starts to play to more and more demographic niches, where you have, all right, the women are going to listen to this station, and the men are going to like the rock on that station. you can sort of see the beginning of what we might now call the long tail. Is that not right? Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. You know, this whole idea that's come up in the internet years of the long tail, the idea that there are these big old media that form the front end and then trailing out from that big ball of fire is this long tail of lots of little affinity groups, such as we might find on the internet, where you hook up with somebody who has an interest in the same medical situation or the same kind of music. That's how our popular culture has changed and is changing. But I would argue, and I try in something in the air to make the point that when we buy into that long tail theory, we are losing out on something very important. We're losing out on the glue, the common social foundation that we had in that top 40 era. And sure, people on top 40 radio weren't talking about important political issues. They were just playing the hits. But it gave people a common foundation. It gave people something to talk about when you meet a stranger, when you're at a bar, when you're at school. And it gives you something to kind of break the ice. And I think that is very important in any society, to have a common conversation going. And we're in danger of losing that now because we're becoming so atomized, both because of the nature of the internet and because of all the corporate and business forces that divide us into those little demographic niches rather than talking to us as one people.
My guest is Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. His new book is Something in the Air. Mark, let's listen to a little clip from LA Radio back in 1948, and then we'll talk about this young DJ on here, a man named Hunter Hancock.
Let's go hunting with Hunter. Good hunting, everybody. This is Hunter Hancock, old H.H., getting ready to do a little hunting around with some of the very best in rhythm and blues records, featuring principally the greatest and most popular Negro musicians, singers, entertainers in the world.
Mark Fisher, who is Hunter Hancock, and what is his legacy in radio?
Hunter Hancock is maybe the one reporting achievement in this book that I'm most proud of, because when I found him a few years ago, he was a 91-year-old man living in a nursing home in Southern California, and nobody had ever heard of this guy, and I just kind of lucked into him. Everybody in history books credits a man named Alan Freed with being the first real rock and roll DJ, and that he was, but he also tends to get credited with being the first white DJ to play black music on the radio, and that turns out not to be the case. It was this guy, Hunter Hancock, in Los Angeles. He was a jazz DJ. His own personal taste was really more Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, but one of those record promoters, who later got in trouble in the whole payola scandal, came by his studio one day and said, "Hunter Hancock, you're playing all the wrong music. If you really want to connect with the audience, you've got to play what were then called race records, which were those early R&B tunes." And Hancock said, "Okay, what the hey, I'll put them on." He puts them on the radio, and people come literally banging on the studio glass. Kids from both whites and blacks all across Southern California come down to the studio and demand more and more of this. He ends up being kind of the Pied Piper of race records and plays them back to back on his radio show for years, and becomes this enormous phenomenon. About 4 or 5 years later, when TV came along, he makes his first TV appearance. And as the camera focuses in on Hunter Hancock, first time many people in Southern California are seeing this man, who they simply assumed was black because he was willing to play black music on the radio. So he looks into the camera and he says, "Well, now you know what old H.H. really looks like." And the whole crowd just breaks into laughter because he was assumed to be black. I went back and listened to those recordings, as you just heard, and he sounds whiter than Wonder Bread.
Right.
But that was the power of suggestion, the power of imagination in radio.
Really amazing. Mark Fisher is my guest. Mark, tell us about a man named Bob Smith.
Bob Smith is better known to most people as Wolfman Jack, and he was a kid from Brooklyn who put on a crazy voice and a crazy act and made himself the subject of fascination and fantasy in the lives of teenagers in California first and then across the country. And there's this wonderful scene at the end of American Graffiti, the George Lucas movie, where the kids are cruising down the street in Modesto, California, and in every car, different kids have a different fantasy about Wolfman Jack, the DJ they listen to every night as they're cruising. And some of them think he's on a pirate ship offshore, and some of them think he's down in Mexico, and some of them think he's illegal, and others think that he's out on his studio just on the outskirts of town playing records. But what they have in common is that he represents rebellion for them, and he represents what they want to be and what rock and roll means to them. And so there's this deep emotional connection that you see in that movie and that people had when they listened to Wolfman Jack and his howling, crazy introductions of songs and his phone calls that he would make, phony phone calls to that would get a laugh all along the cruising strip. He was one of those classic top 40 DJs who was just a wild and crazy character, but he's deeply embedded in the hearts and the memories of people who listened to him growing up.
Mark, what was the true story about the Wolfman? Was he out on a pirate ship?
Well, he was actually, at first, for many years, he worked out of a station in Mexico, and which had an enormously powerful signal because it wasn't restricted by the American FCC rules about how much power you could pump out on your transmitter. So from his perch in Mexico, he could be heard through much of California, although later on in his career, he was in Modesto, in a Northern California community, as depicted in the movie American Graffiti, and even later, he was up in New York at WNBC, but people heard him all over the country in national syndication in the 1970s. But back in the 60s, he was based in Mexico.
My guest is Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. We're talking about the history of radio in America, about his new book, Something in the Air. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour for some local news and weather. We'll have a complete update for you on the closings and delays for schools in our area. And if you'd like to join this conversation with some old radio memories of your own, the phone number is 977-1070. My guest this hour is Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. He writes the Raw Fisher blog at blog.washingtonpost.com, and his new book is Something in the Air, Radio Rock and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Mark, you know, I'm sitting here thinking during the break listening to these commercials, and have lots of commercials always been a part of radio?
Well, maybe not quite as many as we have today, but actually I think we're headed back toward an earlier time because big radio companies especially have realized that they went a little bit too far in that direction. We were reaching a point a few years ago where some of the largest radio station owners were having up to 25 to 30 minutes of commercials per hour, and they were starting to see the audience drift away, understandably, and so now there's a big movement among some of the bigger radio companies to reduce the ad load considerably and make it a little more attractive for people to listen to the radio because, as you mentioned earlier, there's so many competitive media out there right now and so many other forms of radio that have popped up.
Right, right. Mark, tell us about what happened in the mid-50s with the transistor radio. I mean, radio was reborn at that time, wasn't it?
It really was. And, you know, we're living through one of those moments right now where new technology is changing the way we listen to things, the way we conceive of music. The iPod has made an enormous difference. The whole concept of digital downloading has allowed people to really create their own radio stations. But I would argue that it was the innovation of the transistor radio in the mid to late 1950s that played an even more dramatic role in reshaping American popular culture, really American life, because when the transistor radio came along, the radio moved out of the living room, out of that place where the whole family gathered to listen to a particular program, and the transistor radio liberated people to take their music with them, whether it was in the car or under the pillow at night or on the beach, wherever they happened to be going, into the kitchen, more intimate and personal places in life, and that helped change the nature of what was on the radio, and the whole way that people spoke on the radio became much more intimate and informal, and we got away from this whole very formal performance kind of speaking that went on in the golden age, which was more of a theater or movies or television kind of model of performance rather than the one-to-one kind of communication that we now associate with radio. So the transistor radio changed a lot. It also allowed Americans to have a medium that reflected the faster pace of life as American life got a lot quicker in the late 1950s as suburbs popped up, as the interstate highways were built, and Top 40 radio was perfectly suited for that tinny sound of the transistor radio and also for that new pace of life.
Mark Fisher of the Washington Post is our guest. We're talking about his new book, Something in the Air. I have read previously about the Paola scandal. But I will tell you, your coverage of that era in American history, it was fantastic. I mean, it really is the definitive story about the Paola scandal. Tell us what happened. I mean, what was really the deal, the politics that was involved, and why Alan Freed paid such a heavy price, and yet Dick Clark seemed to get off scot-free?
Well, you know, Paola has been part of radio and music in this country going way back even before radio existed. Back in the 1920s, when most people bought their sheet music and played it on their piano at home, there were already song pluggers, promoters who went around and paid a store a little extra to carry a particular song. Well, that tradition continued on through the Top 40 period, where DJs were routinely paid additional payments every week or so by record promoters to push certain songs. And it continues even today. We saw New York State Attorney General, now Governor Eliot Spitzer, going after the big music companies and radio companies for accepting payments to get certain songs on the air. So that's been a continuing phenomenon. But what happened in 1960-61 is Congress decided to get tough, crack down on this whole Paola scandal, and they did it not because they were particularly upset by DJs getting an envelope with $10 in it every Friday. No, it was really more a way to address a real social rift that was going on in the country, where parents felt that the advent of rock and roll was stealing their kids away from them, and they thought that rock and roll and the whole concept of race mixing, this was really an affront to the sensibilities of some adults in this country, and they complained to their congressman, and the congressman decided to hold hearings as a way of cracking down on rock and roll. And so they went after the DJs. No big radio executives fell in the Paola scandal. They instead went after hundreds and hundreds of DJs who lost their jobs at stations across the country, and as a result, DJs lost their role in picking the music that is performed on the radio. Well, the two big targets of those congressional hearings were Alan Freed, who was the sort of pioneering rock and roll DJ, first in Cleveland and then in New York, and Dick Clark, who was a Philadelphia DJ who later became much more famous for his TV show, American Bandstand. The committee had the goods on Dick Clark. There was a big song called 16 Candles. Probably a lot of people still remember it. But when it came out, it was not a success. It didn't even crack the top 100. Until Dick Clark started playing it again and again and again. In fact, he started playing it over and over on his show immediately after he was given a share of the song. He was listed as a co-writer of the song. Well, Dick Clark couldn't read a note of music, but he was listed as the co-writer. In exchange, he played the song over and over again, week after week, until it slowly climbed up and eventually hit number 2 on the hit parade. So that was an example of the power of Paola. But the ABC network stood behind Dick Clark and worked out a deal where he copped to accepting some goodies here and there, but basically blamed his producer for taking all the money in exchange for playing records. The producer took the fall. Dick Clark survived, and Alan Freed got no such deal. He fell. He lost his job, fell deeper and deeper into alcoholism, and died just a couple of years later.
Boy, there's a movie waiting to be done.
Really?
Has there been an Alan Freed movie? Biopic?
There have been a couple of movies, not a biopic. There have been a couple of movies that sort of tangentially get at the Alan Freed story, and certainly he was in a bunch of those early rock and roll movies, but no one's done the Alan Freed story, which would be a great tale.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA. I'm Coy Barefoot. My guest today is Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, and we're talking about his new book, Something in the Air. Mark, who is Cousin Brucey?
Cousin Brucey is somebody who anyone from the New York City area would have heard of, and actually people within a few hundred miles of there, too, because he was a DJ in the Top 40 era on WABC, which was a big powerhouse signal that could be heard especially at night in 20, 25 states across the eastern United States. And Cousin Brucie was a kid from Brooklyn who didn't have a particular shtick. He wasn't especially funny or talented, but he was one of those DJs, and they existed in most big cities across the country, who had a knack for connecting with the love lives and the passions and frustrations of teenagers. And he would spend his evening shift on the phone talking to kids who were calling in about their problems in their love life, and it would get a little bit of the flavor of that on his introductions of songs. And people just lived with him as their background soundtrack. And he was also one of those DJs, and there were many of them across the country, who kind of latched onto the Beatles and became known as the fifth Beatle in whatever city they were in. He played a big role in the Beatles' first visits to New York City. And so he plays a fairly major role in Something in the Air, my book, because he represents those DJs across the country who tapped into that whole baby boomer generation as it came up through teenage years and as it fell in love with rock and roll.
And what happened to him?
Well, he's still on the air. He was first on Top 40 stations into the late 1970s as Top 40 started to die, and then he became, like many of those old Top 40 DJs, a jock on an oldies station, which is where he continued until just a year or so ago when, as is happening across the country, the station he was on dropped the oldies format and came up with something new in an effort to reach a younger audience as that oldies generation got too old for the tastes of most advertisers. And now he's following the path that a lot of those Top 40 DJs have gone on, and he's on satellite radio, on Sirius satellite radio, where he still plays those songs of the 1960s.
My first favorite book of 2007, Something in the Air. The author, Mark Fisher, is our guest. We're going to take a very quick break. We're talking with Mark, and we invite you to join the conversation at 977-1070. When we get back, let's talk about shock radio. We're talking with Mark Fisher of the Washington Post about his new book, Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Mark, I want to play a clip real quick here and let folks listen to this guy. And then I want to talk a little bit about a man named Tom Likas.
Hey, I love your show. It keeps me really entertained on the drive home.
I almost had to stop the car because you are the most frustrating man I've ever heard in my entire life.
I can't believe the advice that you give to men. I mean, you're just ruining it for women.
It's not like I love you or I don't like you, but you're there to listen to.
Now that's all that matters to me.
This one little analogy that sticks in my head is like every rose has its thorn. And I think that's...
Wasn't it Bret Michaels who once said that?
I don't know who it was who said that.
The great philosopher Bret Michaels once said that.
You've got to be about the most cynical individual I have ever heard.
Thank you. I'll take that as the compliment I know you intended it.
The very first time we were together, she got pregnant, and I did have a condom on. I thought about calling Trojan and having them pay my child support, but I don't think that's going to happen.
You never read that 7-mile-long disclaimer that comes with Trojans.
Who actually reads that?
Nobody, because you're busy fumbling to get the damn thing out of the box.
Exactly.
I know.
But
and they're counting on this.
Tom, are you married?
Not now.
No, okay, so evidently you have not met your soulmate in life.
I don't believe, what is this, eHarmony.com? I don't believe there's such a thing as a soulmate.
Abortion is wrong. It is
That is your opinion.
You're murdering...
I'm not murdering anybody. Murder is illegal. I have not murdered anybody.
Animal. You are.
I'm an animal. I'm an animal, all right. There's no doubt I'm an animal. I'll tell you what. Wrap your legs around my neck. I'll show you an animal.
The North Shore.
Mark Fisher's new book is Something in the Air. Mark, the gentleman that we've been listening to, a clip from his radio program, his name is Tom Likas. Tell us about Tom Likas.
Well, Tom Likas is one of those shock jocks, raunch radio guys who was all the rage in the late 1990s, still very popular. He's based in Los Angeles, heard on a lot of stations across the country. And like Howard Stern before him and many others who imitate him across the country, he's one of those guys who just tries to see how far he can push the envelope of good taste and of what is legal to say on the radio. And it's interesting because he grew up as a guy who wanted to do really creative, innovative talk radio. He was for a long time a political talk show host of a liberal persuasion, and he gradually moved more and more into doing shows almost exclusively about sex. And from a very male-oriented perspective, he's generally considered a real woman basher, and he's extremely popular. He holds these listener events where literally thousands of people come to watch him do his radio show, and a parade of women line up to go up on stage and have Tom Likas sign, literally autograph their breasts with a Sharpie pen. It's the kind of thing that it's just, you know, you're slack-jawed watching it. But he is enormously popular, and he's very frank, and I profile him in the book. He's very frank about the fact that he does this not because he thinks there's any great artistic merit to it, but just to sell advertisements, just to get people to listen. And he said there is no level so low that he wouldn't go there as long as it wouldn't get him thrown off the air. And that is a typical attitude, a very frank version of it, that you get among these shock jocks, who are really the creation in many ways of the federal government. Because when the feds deregulated radio and allowed the content to go without federal regulation, what you saw was, first of all, there was this enormous corporate consolidation where a handful of companies bought up thousands of radio stations across the country. And because they had accumulated such a mountain of debt, they needed to pay off that debt and therefore get whatever programming would bring the most people in the door. And they quickly found in the late 1990s that it was this kind of raunch radio that was most successful at it.
We're talking with Mark Fisher of the Washington Post about the history of radio in America. Let's listen to another clip from a different kind of shock jock, a DJ named Jeff Christie.
Margaret and Messina, with a song and the answer to the musical question, whatever happened to Fibber McGee? Boy, congratulate our name and claimant winner, Jeff Rodman of Eastmont. Jeff wins copy going up the country, but it can't eat in 1968 or 69. Take your pick. And also, Jeff, I will send you 2 6-packs of Carefree Sugarless Gum. You can chew it all day. And that'll entitle you to 12 more entries for you in the Carefree Rock Concert Contest. That's a tongue twister. Keep listening to the Jeff Christie Stardust Jockey Show for complete details about this contest.
That's the DJ Jeff Christie from 1972 at KQV in Pittsburgh. Mark, tell folks they might recognize that voice. Who is Jeff Christie?
Jeff Christie, if you recognize the voice and the mannerisms, it's a guy who we now know as Rush Limbaugh. He was, throughout his top 40 DJ career on the radio, he was known as Jeff Christie. A lot of DJs use stage names, and that was his. And it's if you listen to some of these recordings, and they're all available on my website at MarkFisher.com, you will quickly realize that the top 40 show that Jeff Christie did is very similar in structure and format to the talk show that he's become more famous for as Rush Limbaugh. And that's really the secret to the success of people like Limbaugh. You know, people will say, well, it's his conservative message that really gets across to people. But every bit as much of that, it is the top 40 structure, the nonstop go-go kind of pace to the show, where he talks about the callers being essentially the songs, and everything else is just like a top 40 radio station with jingles and musical bumpers in and out of each segment. And he really revolutionized talk radio by taking that top 40 format and glomming it onto talk radio.
Mark Fisher is my guest. Mark, in the time we have left, we've got about a minute left. Can you wax poetic for us here about the future of radio? We've got podcasting, iPods, digital radio, which if folks don't know, when you go digital, every radio signal becomes 2 signals. And so we're talking about doubling, really, the number of radio streams that are now covering America.
Right, exactly. You know, there are all these new technologies, which I think prove to us that there's something absolutely essential and elemental about radio, about the experience of listening to another human being on the radio, whether that's on the internet or through satellite or good old-fashioned broadcast radio. That all remains to be seen. But old-fashioned radio on the free of charge, broadcasted in a local community, I think can still survive and thrive, but it's got to do 2 things. It's got to go back to being very locally focused, shows like yours on stations like yours that really feel like the community that they serve. That's essential. And then the other piece of it is they've got to find a way to revive the format by investing in talent, bringing in a whole new creative generation of people who are going to reach out to Americans and say, look, I know you're swimming in information and in all kinds of music that's available online, but here's an intelligent DJ who's going to be a credible guide, a kind of field guide to what's out there. If radio can play that function, then it will still be vital to Americans' lives.
Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, his new beautiful book is Something in the Air, Radio Rock and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Mark, thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Great. Thanks very much, Coy. And, of course, all of these people we've been talking about, you can hear on the website, which is a lot of fun for folks. It's markfisher.com.
Markfisher.com, and that's Mark with a C.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark. Take care. This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.